From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Denise Chong tells us about her grandmother, a concubine who was sold at the age of 17 to Chong's grandfather. They settled in Vancouver's Chinatown, where the concubine supported the family by serving men at tea houses and gambling halls. Denise Chong has written a family history called The Concubine's Children. Also today, we meet actress Sarah Jessica Parker. She stars in the new comedy Miami Rhapsody. She also starred in Honeymoon in Vegas and L.A. Story. As a girl, she spent a year as Annie on Broadway. And TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts on the coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Algerian television says a car bomb exploded on a crowded sidewalk today near a police station. At least 38 people were killed in Algiers and 256 others were hurt. It's the worst bombing during Algeria's fundamentalist uprising. There's been no claim of responsibility. Several cars were destroyed, windows were shattered several blocks away, and the sidewalk was shredded. People hit by flying glass ran frantically through the street. House Speaker Newt Gingrich told the American Hospital Association annual convention today that America's healthcare system needs some drastic changes. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Gingrich said planners should think about the healthcare system in a different way.
We need a new vision of health in America, which, by the way, precedes healthcare. We need a new set of strategies for health in America. We need new projects for health in America, and we need different tactics for health in America.
Gingrich's new thinking takes a marketplace perspective. For example, he said, if patients were more aware of the price of their medical care, that would drive prices down. And he'd like to see doctors and hospitals freed from unnecessary government regulations. But the House leader didn't outline any specific changes. Everything, he said, is on the table. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Flooding throughout much of northern Europe has reached dramatic dimensions. More than 20 people have died, and thousands have had to evacuate their homes. NPR's Deidre Berger has more on the story from Frankfurt.
More than 10,000 people along the Maas River in Holland have been evacuated. Authorities have ordered another 75,000 people living between the Maas and Rhine rivers to leave by tomorrow morning. Authorities say the continuing pressure of record floodwaters have weakened the Dutch dike system. Further up the Rhine in Cologne, thousands of volunteers are reinforcing hastily erected dikes to keep floodwaters from penetrating even further into the historic old city. Flood experts are predicting all-time flood records along much of the Rhine and Mosel rivers. But authorities say the slower onset of this year's flood gave residents more time to salvage possessions than in last year's record floods. In Frankfurt, helpers are building walls of concrete blocks and sandbags to try and keep the swelling Main River from spilling into the downtown area. More storms are predicted for tomorrow. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
O.J. Simpson's murder trial has resumed. His defense attorney, Johnny Cochran, says L.A. police botched the evidence in the case. Cochran also indicated he'll focus on Detective Mark Furman. The detective testified at Simpson's preliminary hearing last year about finding a bloody glove at the former football player's home. The defense says before that, Furman could have planted the glove to frame Simpson. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 26.5 points to 3,831. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq has fallen 6.5 points to 752. This is NPR. The Citadel is asking an appeals court in Virginia to uphold the South Carolina school's all-male admissions policy. Citadel lawyers note that the court last week backed an alternative program for women being created by the Virginia Military Institute. They say the ruling should apply in the case of Shannon Faulkner, who has a court order saying she should be allowed to become the first female Citadel cadet. An attorney for Faulkner argues the VMI case is different because no women are applying to that school. They say Faulkner is waiting and there is no time to develop a program to meet her needs in South Carolina. In an unprecedented move, Italian sports officials have canceled all events next Sunday to protest yesterday's murder of a young soccer fan in Genoa. NPR's Silvio Poggioli reports from Rome.
A 24-year-old Genoa fan was stabbed in the chest outside the city stadium before a match with the Milan team. The game was stopped at halftime when news of his death was announced. Angry Genoa fans rioted outside the stadium until late evening, while Milan supporters were detained on the bleachers before being escorted home by police. A 19-year-old Milan fan was arrested on suspicion of murder. The victim was the sixth Italian fan to die in 6 years, and the escalating violence around Italy's national passion has triggered a wave of anguish. In canceling Sunday's events, soccer officials ignored a government call for matches to continue, fearing a halt could trigger more violence. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
President Clinton says he knows an economic rescue plan for Mexico is unpopular, but he told the nation's governors today Congress will approve the measure once it sees specific legislation. Some lawmakers are warning support for the Mexican loan guarantee package has begun to evaporate over the past few days, despite heavy lobbying by the administration and initial support by GOP leaders. The plan is intended to help Mexico weather the financial crisis. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1913, Denise Chong's grandfather made the voyage from China to Vancouver in search of work. Because of restrictive immigration laws, he left his wife behind in China. He yearned for companionship in Vancouver, so he purchased a 17-year-old concubine from China. She forged her papers and met him in Vancouver. My guest, Denise Chong, is the granddaughter of that concubine. Chong grew up knowing very little about her family history. The door to the past opened in 1987 when Denise Chong and her mother were in China and tracked down the surviving members of the part of the family which remained in China. Chong tells her family history in the new book The Concubine's Children, the story of a Chinese family living on two sides of the globe. She told me what it meant to be a concubine.
A concubine is the lesser wife. First, the man has his wife who's chosen by his parents, and then any other wife he chooses to take are his concubines. So for my grandmother, right away it was a mark against her. There'd be no wedding ceremony, no wedding biscuits. She was a woman who was paid for, bought, purchased. So, and she would be joining his household, and she would be at the whim and in the servitude of the number one wife. And even any children that the concubine would have would address the wife as the mother.
How did your grandmother become a concubine?
My grandfather left China to make a living in North America. You know, the south of China was like it was like a teapot that poured out men like him in the early part of this century, because China was overrun by bandits and warlords, and even whole families would join thieving gangs. So to make a living, my grandfather went abroad. He had his wife at home. In America, the laws against arriving Chinese had really slammed the door shut in immigration. So it became, just of the men who were here, it became a very bachelor society. And my grandfather became lonely. He didn't frequent the brothels. He decided to buy himself a concubine, to have a woman come from China to join him in Canada. That was a 17-year-old girl. It was my grandmother. She stepped off the boat to meet the man she'd been sold to.
Who sold her?
My grandmother had been sold once already. She'd been sold as a child to a stranger, so she was already a child servant. Whenever her family felt that they couldn't feed another mouth, then the daughters were usually sold like tea. So my grandfather was already buying a child servant to be his concubine. Now, he didn't have the money to actually pay for her. He was a man of just a middle-class peasant abroad. He didn't have the money to pay for her false Canadian papers that would get her into the door. So to pay for all that, she arrived off the boat and found that she was indentured as a tea house waitress.
And what were her responsibilities as a tea house waitress?
First, it was a mark against her to be a concubine. To be a tea house waitress was an even deeper scar, because in those bachelor societies of the Chinatowns all up and down that west coast, the tea houses were where men gathered. And the better a tea house did depended on how attractive were the waitresses, and, you know, how flirtatious they were with their customers, and how young they were, and how well they could hold conversation. And in those days, a waitress was seen as one and the same, almost as a prostitute, that they were there to woo men to spend money.
So in the meantime, your grandfather had two wives. He had his first wife and the wife with the higher stature, who was in China.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had his concubine, your grandmother, who was with him in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife at home in China was living, a rural life with her children. And the concubine in Vancouver was living this life of alcohol and gamblers and tea houses. And, it just couldn't be further apart.
Yes. And yet the notion that bound them together was that they were of the same family and that the concubine was still under the authority of the wife at home. That one day the concubine would live her life out under the same roof as the wife. So that loyalty kept my grandmother bound to my grandfather for a time, enough for her to hand over her wages made from waitressing, to hand over her tips even, so that my grandfather could take it and, meet his first loyalties, which were to the family at home.
So your grandmother actually supported the family in China?
Yes, although my mother did not really understand that as a child.
What about you? Did your mother tell you when you were young that your grandmother was a concubine?
I always knew the term. I was always aware that my grandmother came into this country under a false Canadian birth certificate. I didn't really understand the notion of more than one wife as a child, but I knew that among the photographs in the bottom drawer of my the cedar chest in my parents' bedroom upstairs were these two girls posed arm in arm. And I knew that photograph was of my mother's two sisters. I knew that the grass poking up at their feet and, tickling their ankle socks, I knew that soil was China.
The two daughters in China that you saw the photograph of, these were children that your grandmother, the concubine, had, but had to send back to the wife at home in China.
The wife at home got wind that my grandfather had taken a concubine and had even a household in Gold Mountain, two daughters that had been born in Vancouver. So when she got wind of that, my grandfather feared she'd commit suicide to save face, so he hastened home with these two daughters. And while they were there living in an adobe house in a small patch of land, probably not bigger than this studio, while there the concubine became pregnant. And she goes to a blind fortune teller who can see the truth. And he says to her, "You're carrying a son." And sons are what the concubine felt would redeem her. So she gets it into her head. She remembers she's got this false Canadian birth certificate. She gets into her head that she wants this son born in Canada. She convinces my grandfather. They leave the two girls behind. 3 days after the boat docks back in Vancouver, in a back alleyway of Chinatown on the second floor of a tenement, my mother is born.
You write in your book that your grandmother, the concubine, never really spoke much about the past, and that your grandfather didn't either, and he died when you were very young.
Mm-hmm.
What about your mother? Did she speak much about your grandparents?
When I would ask my mother about the past when I was a girl, it was to get her to tell me the stories from her girlhood that I could relate to as a girl myself. But those stories, I only looked for the when I could laugh and when I could cry. And I remember that the stories all seemed to me to be sad. I could picture my mother at the side of her mother at the mahjong table. I could see her in the loneliness of the opera theater, seeing a Chinese opera that she'd seen over and over and over and over again, but that her mother wanted her to watch because so that she'd know where she was. I'd picture my mother walking home down a back alleyway, having to walk through the garbage in the alleyway and the men off Skid Row looking for, things at restaurants had thrown away. My mother'd go up a dark staircase and she'd live in a rooming house. So all those stories carried tears with them. And then as I grew older and I started to leave those stories, my girlhood behind, my mother began to talk less and less about the past. Eventually, you know, when my grandmother died in a car accident, it'd be like a guillotine coming down. Years would pass, and I would have this sense that my mother almost leaned with her back against the door that would keep out the past. Almost a sense that the windows had even been painted shut over the cracks. You couldn't even lift the window up.
Your mother grew up in Chinatown. Your grandparents lived in Chinatown. How much connections did you have with Chinatowns when you were growing up?
When I was little and we would go to Chinatown to visit my grandmother, Chinatown was still, it still had a semblance of activity. This would be in the early 50s. The Chinatowns would be dying over this period because of there was no new blood coming in because immigration still had not really opened up. By the time we moved away from Vancouver and were living in the north of British Columbia, Chinatown, for me, became the embodiment of all the fears I had that surrounded my grandmother's past. So when my father we'd drive down the 500 miles to Vancouver, we'd call on my grandmother, and my father would pull up to the curb of whatever rooming house was her latest address. And we'd stop, and we'd have to go. He and one of the kids would go up the staircase, and we'd knock at my grandmother's door, and we'd wait to see if she'd answer. And if she didn't answer, we knew that she'd had too much to drink the night before. And we'd have to come back when she'd dried out. So those dark staircases and the anxiety of waiting to see if the door would open to us. Then when we do come back the next day, I'd be sitting in her room. My parents would go run an errand. Maybe my grandmother would be cooking for us in the communal kitchen. And we'd be sitting in the rooming house, and there would just be the tick-tock of the alarm clock on her bed, or a mouse skittering behind the dresser, or the shuffle of old men past her door. So to me, Chinatown was something, again, that it was the past that I wanted to leave behind. It was frightening to me as a child.
My guest is Denise Chong, and she's written a new memoir called The Concubine's Children, the story of a Chinese family living on two sides of the globe. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Denise Chong, and she's written a memoir about her family. It's called The Concubine's Children. I'm going to jump ahead in the story a little bit. In 1987, you were living in China, in Beijing, mm-hmm. with your husband, who was there on assignment. He's a reporter. And when you were there, you decided to try to track down the part of your family that stayed in China, your grandfather's wife at home. Mm-hmm. as she was called. Mm-hmm. And you were able to do that. You were able to find the family. And then you had to convince your mother to come to China and actually meet that part of the family.
Right.
One of the siblings that your mother met in China was her sister. It was one of the daughters that your grandmother gave back to the wife at home in China.
Yes, it was the eldest, my mother's eldest sister, who was Vancouver-born, but who would live out her life in China. The first thing that sister had clutched in her hand a photograph for the moment that the two sisters would meet, and the photograph is a picture of the concubine holding her firstborn on her lap. It's taken in a studio in Vancouver, and my aunt turned this crackling yellowed photograph over and showed it to my mother, and you know, drew her line under some words printed in English, and the English says "Made in Canada." So right away, my aunt then just turned to my mother, the two sisters turned to each other, and my aunt said to my mother, "You and I drank the same mother's milk." And when they walked arm in arm to go to the house that my grandfather had built, the moment my mother and I saw this grand two-story house, which was such a far cry from the dark, dingy, dank rooming houses that my mother had grown up in, the moment we saw that, the moment we walked through the door and saw on the wall were photographs of my mother as a child. On the wall was a huge regulator clock that had been made in Canada. The moment we saw that, my mother then knew that this was where we could begin to make sense of her life in Canada. This was where the family story would become one.
So we have two families uniting here. One is the family of your grandfather's concubine,
mm-hmm.
who was your grandmother, and the other is the family of his wife who stayed in China. And that's the family that you met when you were in China. The family in China didn't think very highly of your grandmother, the concubine.
This is the difficulty of writing the family memoir and wrestling it flat onto the page. There are as many different versions of events and opinions of people as there are members of the family. My relatives in China revered my grandfather. The house stood as a monument to his memory. It was him from afar who had kept alive the sense of family, kept them, sustained them through hard times, gave them reason to go on.
Although he was rarely in China.
Yes, he only cradled his newborn son from the wife at home for a couple of months before he left. He never saw he would not see his wife or his daughters from the concubine again. But they revered my grandfather. What they did not know in China was that the money that my grandfather sent to China was money that he came to collect from my grandmother. So when my mother arrived in China, she knew what the sacrifices her mother had gone through and the price that she had paid of going to the pawn shop, of trying to make her earn her living gambling, of eventually succumbing to after hours demands of the tea house waitressing. My mother could not upset the family's reverence for my grandfather by saying to them, "Look, you know, what you have here is the work of the concubine," because it would have destroyed the sense of the family in China. It was better to leave them with the sense that it was the wife at home who had sacrificed in her loneliness and anguish for her husband. It was better for them to think that my grandfather had been the one who'd sacrificed by living out his life alone, by not having the company of a wife.
So she never told them the real story about how her grandmother, the concubine, sent the money to China?
No, she did not.
Do you have any idea what impact your visit had on the part of your family that stayed in China?
It sadly kept alive for them my grandfather's dream that anything must be better than China, that going abroad must be better. No matter how good things are in China, things abroad must be brighter. It's like always, you know, moving to the next valley. That if they went abroad, then they could secure an education and a future for their children. They looked at us with great longing. Looked at me and thought, well, couldn't our children be like that? Couldn't we go to Canada or America and set down the roots of the tree if it produces blossoms and leaves like me? So it was as if the cycle had just gone full circle. My grandfather's son in China was saying the same things my grandfather did a generation ago. Could we think of a way to get his daughter and sons out of China? He was negotiating with a middleman that would get his daughter to Panama. He was trying to think of a way to get them into the States and Canada ultimately.
Like so many people who are the grandchildren of immigrants, you grew up really knowing very little about your family past. I mean, your family had basically decided, as you say, to shut the door on the past. Mm-hmm. But now you've written a family history. You've learned as much about that past as you could. How have you been changed by that entering into the past?
I think when you reconcile and make peace with the past, you chart a more independent course for the future. Yes, I'm sorry that my grandmother had to, you know, would stepped off the boat at 17 and was already sold, and I'm sorry that she had all those marks against her before she'd even had any control over her life. But at the same time, I see what is good about that sense of family, that it spans generations, that what the sacrifice of one generation sometimes is not repaid in that generation, but it's repaid in the next. So though my grandmother had the shame of being a concubine, the pride has been restored because I've gone to China. I've seen the fruits of her labors. I've seen that house that was built, the bricks that were sanded to go into it, the tiles that were painted, the paintings on the wall to embellish the house. I've seen that for her dead eyes, you know, if that's possible. So I've taken from a sense of family that and a continuum of generations that it is possible to reconcile with the past.
Denise Chang, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Denise Chang is the author of the new memoir, The Concubine's Children, The Story of a Chinese Family Living on Two Sides of the Globe. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with actress Sarah Jessica Parker. She starred opposite Steve Martin in L.A. Story, and she was the frustrated fiancée of Nicolas Cage in Honeymoon in Vegas. Now she's starring as a young woman having second thoughts about marriage in the new film Miami Rhapsody. She started acting as a child and even did a year on Broadway as Annie. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he's optimistic he and the nation's governors can work together on serious national problems, even though they may have their differences. He's met today with the nation's governors, and he told them he wants to cooperate, but he has concerns about the balanced budget amendment and budget reforms on welfare.
We must pass welfare reform this year, and it's got to be real, meaningful, different, and better and broader than anything we've ever done before. And it ought to give you a great deal of flexibility out of, if nothing else, out of a sense of simple humility that no one has all the answers to deal with these difficult riddles that threaten the stability of our families and the future of our kids.
The president warned the balanced budget amendment will mean major changes in federal funding. He's urging governors to make Republicans spell out the effects it might have. The government says Americans had more money last month. The Commerce Department says personal income rose 0.8%. That means for all of 1994, earnings rose 6.1%. That's the biggest jump in 4 years. Americans also spent more in December. Personal spending rose 0.3%, and spending was up more than 5.5% last year. That's the smallest increase since 1991. Consumer spending makes up about 2/3 of the economic activity in the United States. New doubts are surfacing about a daguerreotype of Abraham Lincoln. It's not certain if it's really him in the image. Diane Bihar of member station WFDD reports from Winston-Salem.
Debate has raged for some time among experts as to whether the photo, taken in about 1843, is or is not the earliest known picture of the 16th president. The daguerreotype shows a young, clean-shaven man with his right hand partially tucked inside his coat. The veins on the hand are quite prominent, and that's what Dr. Monty Leonard zeroed in on. Leonard is an emergency room doctor at a North Carolina hospital and a history buff. He got a documented copy of a casting of Lincoln's right hand from the Smithsonian Institution and compared the vein patterns with those of the man in the Hoffman daguerreotype. The vein patterns don't match. Leonard will present his findings in February at a meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Scientists. For National Public Radio, I'm Diane Bihar in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
The governing body of the Smithsonian Institution has decided to jettison most of a planned exhibition of the Enola Gay and the atomic age the plane ushered in. The National Air and Space Museum will instead show just the fuselage of the plane and possibly a video of the memories of the crew. Veterans groups and many members of Congress complained the planned exhibit was biased, showing America as the aggressor in the Pacific War. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 26 points to end at 3,832. Declining at issues led advances by a 7-4 margin. This is NPR. Japanese officials now say it will cost $85 billion to rebuild parts of central Japan flattened by the devastating earthquake. That compares to some $20 billion needed to fix damage from last year's California earthquake in Northridge. More than 100,000 Japanese buildings were damaged or destroyed. The economy in the city of Kobe has been devastated. One leading department store has announced it will sell $7 million worth of land to cover losses. Small and medium-sized businesses are the worst affected. Officials say more than 1,500 firms are asking the government and banks for credit to rebuild. The slow diplomacy to get North and South Korea back to the negotiating table has suffered another setback. The South has rejected the North's offer to sit down with South Korea's main opposition leader. They were to talk about better relations between the two nations. From Pyongyang, North Korea, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
South Korea has insisted that any détente with North Korea must be the product of the two governments discussing their future, including reunification, and not the result of individuals meeting independently. Washington has been applying pressure on Pyongyang to resume the inter-Korean dialogue and has made it a condition of the nuclear agreement the U.S. and North Korea signed last October. However, Pyongyang last week rebuffed Seoul's proposal to hold talks at the vice minister's level. The ongoing tit-for-tat exchanges between the North and South are not likely to upset the fragile peace here, but they do make prospects for a healthy dialogue leading to reunification seem a long way off. In Pyongyang, North Korea, this is Julie McCarthy.
One in every four American kids who's six or younger is mired in poverty. The report by the National Center for Children in Poverty says the number ballooned by a million kids by 1992. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sarah Jessica Parker, starred opposite Steve Martin in L.A. Story, Nicolas Cage in Honeymoon in Vegas, and Johnny Depp in Ed Wood. Now she's starring in the new comedy, Miami Rhapsody. She plays an advertising copywriter who's just accepted a marriage proposal, only to discover that everyone in her family is having a secret affair. And that's shaking her confidence in the very idea of marriage. In this scene, she's shopping for a wedding cake with her fiancé, played by Gil Bellows, but she's getting cold feet, so she tries to talk him into just living together.
We're not going to feel trapped. Being together is going to be like an opportunity, not an obligation.
Well, I don't want to live together. I want to get married.
Really? You don't see it as a dying institution?
No, I still think marriage works. My parents had a wonderful marriage.
Yeah, well, please, your parents were saints. They could probably cure leprosy, too.
Okay, you just got this idea in your head that marriage leads to misery.
Well, it's true. Married women get depressed more than single women.
Because they marry the wrong people.
Well, how can you be so positively sure that we're the right people? I mean, look at these two. Third time's a charm? Please, who's to say that that's not going to be us one day?
So fine. You just want to live together? Is that what you want? You want to skip the wedding?
No, we can get married. Go ahead, pick a cake. Anything you want, as long as it's chocolate.
Sarah Jessica Parker started her acting career as a child in theater, including a year-long stint on Broadway as Annie when she was 14. Her parents encouraged her artistic inclinations and were thrilled when, as a girl, she landed a part in a Harold Pinter production of The Innocents. The play starred Claire Bloom, who was living with Philip Roth. These were people her parents were enamored of. Sarah Jessica Parker remembers this as being an idyllic time.
Both Harold and especially Claire took sort of a personal interest in my well-being and took care of me. I mean, Claire would make me come to dinner with her because I was on the road away from my family. She'd make me come to dinner with her and only eat fresh vegetables, and she would check and see what I was reading all the time. And she would make sure whatever city that we went to on the road before we came into Broadway that I took ballet classes with the ballet company that was affiliated with the city. And she used to say to me all the time, you know, please don't become a professional child. I worry, you know, whatever happens, just don't become a professional child.
When she said a professional child, did she mean a professional child actor or someone who makes a profession out of being a kid?
The latter, yes. Oh. She was really worried about she was worried about cutesy, you know. She was worried about that polished showbiz sort of young Ethel Merman thing. The same thing my parents were. That was their biggest concern, was that I turn into like a commodity of some sort. And well, they knew the limitations of that, obviously.
Speaking of young Ethel Merman, hey, you were Annie on stage for 2 years. That's young Ethel Merman training school.
I know. I was the blemish. I was the, I don't know, to this day, I'm not certain how that all happened. I mean, I'm very grateful for the experience, and I loved it, but I was, as my father said when we first saw that show, we got standing room, and we went to see it right after it opened on Broadway, and he said, oh, you know, Sarah Jessica, you're not Annie material. And I said, you know, why, beyond the vocal, you know, limitations that I had? And he said, you know, you just don't. You don't look it, you don't sound it, you know. The girls were built physically a certain way that I was just not, although I felt my physical presence was appropriate for the Depression era. I thought they all should be wayfish and, you know, look like they were eating off of rationed food stamps and things like that. but my father said no, because the girls were stronger than me. But it was one of those crazy flukes. You know, when you're a kid, nothing really matters. So you audition and you have no fear, and you end up, you accumulate a lot of things that you don't realize are difficult to get later in life.
What was the best and worst part of being Annie?
The best part was singing with a live orchestra every night, you know, like a 30-piece orchestra or something crazy like that. And the people that I met, who I simply adored. And I think the worst part was trying to define myself when I left the show, being, you know, having a really hard time internally trying to figure out what I wanted and who I was, not what everybody else wanted me to be, meaning in the theater community. That was a really kind of awkward period for me.
What did people want you to be?
Well, I just think they wanted me to sing really loudly. You know, people wanted me to do Broadway musicals after I left the show, and I really, you know, the minute I left the show, within hours, my hair was dyed back to my own color, and I wanted to go to high school and, or at least be around, you know, regular children my age, and I wanted to be part of something where I was one of many and not alone. And I don't think that's what people in the theater community had in mind. I mean, legitimately, they wanted me to, you know, be a big singer. And, you know, I had come from straight drama. You know, I'd come from Harold Pinter and Claire Bloom. And, you know, the television experiences that I had had in Cincinnati were all about, you know, high drama, crises. And I thought I was a serious actress, and I thought that was just a fluke that this had happened in Annie. And I was, you know, like I said, I was proud to be one of the Annies, but I was afraid it was going to retard the rest of my career in some way.
I think the first time I saw you perform was in Square Pegs, the TV series that was on in, what, 82, I think it was?
Yep, 82 or 83. Yeah, 82.
And you played a high school student, and, you know, you had a best friend who both thought of yourselves as being, you know, really out of it, not ready for the cool crowd, but
right.
But you were probably the most interesting girls in the school, right?
Oh, I think we were.
Yeah. So I liked that series a lot. It didn't last on TV very long, but
no.
But it was good. Was that a good experience for you?
Yeah, it was a great experience, and I think... you know, I happen to have had really good experiences in television, and they've all been really short-lived. They've all...
Oh, Equal Justice?
Equal Justice, and a show right before that called A Year in the Life. But all of my television experiences have been critically very successful and creatively very satisfying. And Square Pegs was really, I think, great because it was my first real experience in Los Angeles, and it was so different. And my parents up to that point had been so wary of me doing a television series and had done everything that they could kind of to stop it. And this was a smart show, and it was sophisticated, and it was so unique. And that was my first experience really in Hollywood, you know. And I was working with such good people. And so for me, I think it in the end ultimately allowed me to continue to work in television because I assumed that all my experiences would be like that, and I wasn't turned off by it. I think the only down part of that was the impact for a long time that it had on my career in terms of people thinking of me as anything other than Patty Green, which was my name on the show. You know, I was for 10 years playing the cerebral best friend, you know, of the pretty girl.
Better that than Annie, right?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, provides a challenge, but once you do it a few times, you want to sort of experience new and different roles.
My guest is actress Sarah Jessica Parker. She stars in the new comedy, Miami Rhapsody. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Sarah Jessica Parker. was the first role where you felt like you were not only playing an adult, but you were playing a three-dimensional and sexual adult?
Although some might disagree with me, I would have to say L.A. Story in terms of film. Even though she was, you know, just for lack of a better word, she was a bimbo. She was Steve Martin's bimbo and was a lot more complicated. And I think she obviously was someone who operated, you know, from her own, like from the point of view of her sexuality. And she was an adult. And that was the first time I'd ever really been given an opportunity to play that.
Did Steve Martin cast you in the role?
I think ultimately, you know, he had say along with the director, but he was also serving in a producer capacity. So I think he did ultimately. I had to read with him a couple times and screen test with him, and I don't think if he'd been uncomfortable, he would have given the okay. So I credit him, and you know, in the end, with casting me.
Now, how much older is he than you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm 29, so he's maybe just in his 50s.
So he's about 20 years older.
Yeah.
No, was that, one of the things that women in Hollywood complain about all the time is that older men get roles and older women don't, you know, mature women don't. So you always have younger women playing opposite older men. Was there anything that was uncomfortable about that for you?
Not a thing. I mean, politically, even it wasn't, because that was exactly her part in the movie. Her, you know, Victoria Tennant would say in the film, yeah, I mean, you're so obvious, you're so common, you know, you're choosing to spend time with somebody who doesn't threaten you or doesn't challenge you, you know, it's so easy, you just run off with some sort of, you know, little chippy. So it wasn't hard to play it, and obviously he wasn't hard to play opposite at all. I mean, quite the contrary. He was just, he was dreamy, you know. But I do know what you're talking about. I mean, there is a huge discrepancy. I mean, if a more mature woman were to play opposite a younger man, it would be a huge issue. It would be a cover story on every entertainment magazine, you know. Big risks taken in Hollywood.
You're right. Well, you know, that reminds me of a bit of a sidebar here. Your stepfather, I believe, is about 8 years younger than your mother.
Yeah. And I think he may be even 9 years younger than my mother.
That's becoming much more accepted now than it probably was when they were married. Did that ever make you uncomfortable around friends? Did they ever think it was odd? And were you ever asked to, you know, defend it?
You know what? It never once came up. My mother, maybe it's because my mother always, she looks very young. She always has, and she's very small, and maybe that's why, but it's interesting. It's just, you're the first person that's mentioned. It's never come up. But, you know, my family was kind of strange anyway, so I guess they just assumed, if anyone thought about it, that it was just all part of the weird package.
What else was strange about your family?
Oh, you know, we were real messy, and we didn't have any matching linens or furniture, and we were very, you know, we were very poor, and our house was really an eyesore to the neighborhood. In fact, the sheriff would come over on more than one occasion and tell us to clean up our yard. We somehow always managed to move into these very wealthy, beautiful old neighborhoods with lots of fancy people, good people often, but fancy, because the schools were good. So my parents would manage to get a house in these nice neighborhoods, and we were always, you know, we were unsightly, we were unseemly, we were an eyesore. My parents screamed and yelled at each other, and the neighbors could hear. And
did anybody ever call the police?
Oh, they may have. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. But you know, this, I'm not talking too much out of school here. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, it's now kind of one of the funny stories you tell at Christmas.
Did you have the lawn? You know how every neighborhood has a family that has a lawn with like old tires on it, and old like wrought iron things that nobody knows what they are. And
well, worse,
metal.
Well,
things.
we had no grass, and we had a tire swing. But guess where everybody congregated?
On the tire swing. No.
Our yard. All the kids' the whole neighborhood. Of course, because we were the fun house. You know, we were allowed to sit on the furniture. We were allowed to roller skate. In fact, we were encouraged to roller skate in our house because if you opened all the doors, it went in a full circle like a donut. So we were allowed to roller skate inside and ride our bikes inside. And kids would come in and out of our house. And my mom would actually make cookies and bring them out. And people hung out on our in our front yard because it was the fun, relaxed house. You know, they were our parents were politically very relaxed and kind of they were groovesters, and that's exactly what our house looked like. And you know, our vegetables came from a, like a co-op or whatever, I don't know, whatever that is. I mean, they were, you know,
so they were messy, but they were bohemians.
They were messy bohemians, but it was strange because there was also the strange dichotomy. My mother was incredibly strict and puritanical in a lot of the other ways that she raised us. It was very, very complicated and hard to understand as a child.
Strict about what?
Oh, well, you know, all the boys had to wear like navy blue wool Eton suits with Peter Pan collars, and they wore like lederhosen in the dead of winter and little shorts. And the girls wore always hand smock dresses and plaids, tartans, and saddle Oxfords and little tiny white socks. And we always had our hair in perfect big Russian bows, you know, and we looked when we'd go to the opera every night and the ballet and the symphony and stuff. And we sort of like, my mother raised us, actually, timely as it is, she raised us exactly how Rose Kennedy raised her children. That's exactly what she modeled herself after.
Well, I could see how you would definitely get mixed messages between roller skating around the house and having the bows in your hair.
Exactly, with like, you know, roaches in your house and, you know, strange vermin. And yet you'd walk outside and we would really look like old money rich kids, like good old fashioned, you know, Roman Catholic. And we were, first of all, some of us are Jews. Some of us are, we don't know what we are. Some of us were baptized. I mean, it was crazy.
Where's the rest of your family now in terms of show business?
Well, I have a brother named Timothy Britton, who's an incredible actor. He's in New York, and he does a lot of theater. He's actually one of the founding members of a company called Naked Angels. And I have actually a little sister who was in the whole run of Evita on Broadway, and she is now a second camera assistant. She pulls focus. And I have my eldest brother, Pippin, is a playwright and a screenwriter, and is writes for a children's television show. And then my sister Rachel is not in the theater anymore at all. She is a physician's assistant in the she does heart surgery. And then I have a little brother, Andrew, who just graduated from college with a degree in theater of, I don't understand what the degree is myself, but he's been the stage manager in New York and is pursuing acting. And let's see, my little sister Allegra, who was with the Metropolitan Opera for, oh, 7 or 8 seasons. And then I have a little brother, Aaron, who is 16 and who's just joined the ambulance corps.
Interesting family.
I hope I've not forgotten somebody. I don't think I have. I'll feel terrible.
Sarah Jessica Parker, she stars in the new film Miami Rhapsody. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the controversial Enola Gay exhibit at the Smithsonian?
Well, we'll have news that the Smithsonian has decided to scuttle the exhibit, but to display the Enola Gay, the aircraft from which the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing from Orhan Pamuk, who's a Turkish novelist, the author of a book, The Black Book, that's recently been translated into English and published here. He talks about writing about the city of Istanbul and other matters. Also, the campaign of the White House and many in both parties and among the establishment to support loan guarantees for Mexico, a cause that seems increasingly difficult on Capitol Hill.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The murder trial of O.J. Simpson resumed today. Since last Monday, TV critic David Bianculli has been on the O.J. watch, covering every minute of the courtroom proceedings with 7 TVs and VCRs going at the same time. After 1 week, here's what he has to say.
Don't complain to me about too much O.J. TV coverage. I've been watching every weekday and comparing the coverage of CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, CNN, Court TV, even the E! Entertainment Network. That's about 9 hours a day, 5 days a week, times seven TVs. If OJ hours were like frequent flyer miles, I'd be halfway around the world by now. So what have I learned from all this? First of all, I've confirmed something I suspected from the start. This story isn't worth wall-to-wall coverage. ABC seems to have realized that already. It's covered the story less than any other network. And once witnesses begin to take the stand, I expect the broadcast networks will fall into either some sort of rotation system or settle for news breaks and occasional live break-ins. But when those networks aren't looking, that's when coverage of the Simpson trial seems to get more interesting, and sometimes even informative. The problem with CBS, NBC, and ABC is that they're so loaded up with reporters and guest experts, they'd rather listen to them most of the time than pay attention to what's happening in the courtroom. That's where Court TV comes into play and blows away all the competition. Whenever Judge Ito allows cameras and microphones to be turned on in the courtroom, Court TV is there. And that gives lots of insight into the law and into the tactics and personalities of the lawyers. My favorite Court TV moment so far came last Tuesday, during the last-minute arguments about what Johnny Cochran could include during his opening statements. To make a point, Cochran quoted from a movie, but Judge Ito probably made him wish he hadn't.
You know, there was a recent movie, Your Honor, where there's a line which I think is very appropriate in this case. I think it was A Few Good Men. We keep hearing about the truth. I don't think they can stand the truth. That's what Jack Nicholson said. You don't want to hear the truth. And that's, I think, it's very appropriate in this situation. That's exactly what's happening here. There's one other thing
I'd
like to point out.
Wasn't he the bad guy? Wasn't he the bad guy?
Yeah, but bad guys say something worthwhile sometimes, Your Honor. So even bad guys tell the truth on occasion, Your Honor. Certainly we aren't the bad guys in this case, Your Honor. Your Honor, with regard to one other thing...
When Cochran slipped the names of a lot of surprise witnesses into his opening remarks last Wednesday, and the defense team claimed they had just found those witness statements that very morning, Court TV had the strongest and most informed opinions of all. A former judge, one expert among many, nailed the defense that night with a very persuasive observation.
I can't believe that the defense team doesn't have a computerized record of every piece of paper they have. If they don't, then I don't understand what Simpson is paying them for. I mean, there has to be a computerized record of every piece of paper, log in, log out, and for them to say we just didn't know that these statements weren't turned over is just inconceivable.
Well, let's not forget.
Those are the moments that make watching all these days of OJ worthwhile. And at least at this point, the trial coverage is over by primetime. So if I want to watch more TV, I can sit back, relax, and get my mind off the trial. Like tomorrow night, for example, I can watch that new Fox telemovie, The O.J. Simpson Story.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.